Hello and welcome to Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas. Each episode, we take a big issue which is driving our world and with experts try to unpick how it's going to shape the future. Today, we're discussing the genome. The idea of sequencing the whole human genome to provide biology and science with all manner of new knowledge and new therapies that could revolutionise our understanding of the makeup of humans arose in the 1980s. By 1990, the Human Genome Project was launched. It promised high hopes of diagnosing, preventing and treating diseases such as Alzheimer's, diabetes, Parkinson's and cancer. So how much has been achieved and where are we going with its development today? Joining me is a scientist central to initiating the Human Genome Project in 1984 and the Personal Genome Project in 2005. George Church is Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and Professor of Life Sciences and Technology at Harvard University and MIT. I asked him to start from the beginning.
So, in 1973 or so, I was working on one of the few molecules that had a nucleic acid sequence, and I typed them all in, which was possible to do back then, would be very hard to do today. And then I got a taste of it, and I said, well, why don't we do this for every species, in particular for humans? So that was not really genomics, that was just transfer RNA. That was the start.
And that was towards what, identifying effectively the key to each organism?
The tRNA is something that's conserved in all organisms, but there are many other things that varied among them and things that vary between human to human. And those were some of the more interesting parts.
And you wanted to do this why? What would be the benefits of getting it other than the pure science?
Well, a huge fraction of human diseases are influenced by one's personal differences from other people, sometimes called precision medicine or personalized medicine. That wasn't called that way back then, but almost all of biotechnology is now predicated on having the sequence of whatever gene or protein or genome you're dealing with.
And was there much interest, I mean, in funding what is presumably pretty expensive research?
Well, my goal has always been to make expensive research less expensive. And ironically, there was a lot of money available. The government was very enthusiastic about it back in the early 80s when we proposed it at $3 billion, which was assumed a little bit of progress, but not that lot. But now that it's $300 instead of the $3 billion, it depends more on private funding than on government.
And why is that?
Well, I think the idea is that the government wanted to set the field, you know, set it up so that our society would be a leader in this field of science, and so it was worth the government investment. But once it established it was of great value to healthcare, then I think the feeling is that now private healthcare and the like should be able to pick up the slack and pay for it and get return on investment.
And that was what was happening in the U.S. Did you have any serious international competition?
We had international cooperation mainly in England and then later internationally, Europe, China, so forth. That's still more or less the case for genomics.
Two projects you've been involved with, the Human Genome Project and then the Personal Genome Project. How much application has there been as a result of those discoveries and those breakthroughs?
Throughout biotech, ranging from making vaccines to making drugs to diagnosing, you know, serious genetic diseases at various stages, it's extremely widespread throughout biomedicine and agriculture.
And has it surprised you the extent to which it's been deployed or the extent to which perhaps it hasn't been exploited?
I would say that the extent to which genomics is used in biotech is pleasantly higher than most people expected. I think that the application to serious inherited diseases is much less than it could be. In principle, every family has a good chance of it happening to them. And so basically everybody who's of reproductive age would benefit from it, and their healthcare services would benefit both reputationally and financially by helping them do that for themselves.
How would that work?
So it's done at many different stages. At adults, you can use it for preventative surgeries and therapies, for example, removal of tissues that are at risk for cancer. at newborns. There's inborn errors in metabolism you can correct with either drugs or diet choice. Earlier, you can, at preconception, premarital, you can use those to just avoid. By carrier screening, you can avoid making very seriously affected individuals. So it's a range, and of course, gene therapy. So it's a range of options depending on the stage and the particular diseases.
And in reproductive terms, does it involve making sure that certain tendencies are not passed on or stopping people from breeding? How does it work?
It's not stopping anything. It's allowing individuals to make decisions about who they would like to marry and whether, you know, a source of spontaneous abortion, having problem with miscarriages, how you can fix that. That's often done with in vitro fertilization to overcome those reproductive problems. There are many, many options, but the one that's probably least medical and most impactful is genetic counseling prior to marriage, which is not the most adopted, but it is probably the most powerful long-term.
And that involves basically looking at the genome of the couple and seeing what the compatibilities and failings in the system would be. Is that right?
That's right. That's one way to do it. You can also do it looking at genomes of people that have never met and deciding whether it's about 3% of couples would have a serious carrier status disease. So it doesn't preclude most, let's say, dating options.
That would, of course, require people to have their own genomes, to have paid whatever it costs to get a genome.
Well, it's almost free at this point. I mean, it's come down from $3 billion to $300, and the $300 can be recovered just from the healthcare costs that you avoid by using it. So the couple, or the couples, plural, should not have to pay for that. That's not where we are exactly right now, but the healthcare system should be able to do that very easily, given current technology. It's not a technological thing. It's just a willingness to do it.
Do you think United States or a country like Britain will ever move to a point where sort of automatically everyone gets their genome done?
I think we're very close for quite a few countries, United Arab Emirates, UK, Iceland, China, probably leaders in this.
But at the moment, in all those countries, it's still quite a small percentage of the adult population, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I think there will be a tipping point where, you know, it's like the tipping point where we went from nobody having a cell phone to everybody having a cell phone. I think that's not always technological. Sometimes it's, you know, spreading the word by word of mouth that it's useful.
And the massive advantage would be if we look at the difference between prevention and therapy, treatment, it would be largely at the preventative level, so saving problems from occurring.
That's right. So most of these very serious diseases are either untreatable, which means they have to be given palliative care and other expensive and painful maintenance of life status, or there are orphan drugs, which are, you know, cost millions of dollars per dose or per lifetime in some cases. And so that could be saved in addition to all the pain and suffering for not just the individual, but the whole family. So it seems like there's a lot of motivation. It's just a matter of time before people realize the value of this. Because they're individually rare, they're kind of dismissed as being rare, but they're collectively common on the order of 3% of births. And so it's a bit like seatbelts, is that people realize that seatbelts were helpful in a public health sense, but it took a while to convince everybody to use them.
However, we shouldn't ignore the fact that, as you said at the beginning, from the genome, it is possible to have a great deal of therapy for people with existing conditions, is it not?
Yeah, that's true for maybe 1% out of the 3%, but maybe 1% have things that they can do, even as adults, because the diseases are late onset and have surgical or medical interventions. But for a lot of them, the only real intervention, the only prevention that we have that's cost-effective, and in some cases the only one period, is through genetic counseling.
So what would you see as the prospects of using genome and gene therapy to deal with things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or cancers?
In a way, gene therapies and cell therapies, which are related, are already used for cancer. That's CAR-T therapy is a kind of gene or cell therapy. Some of the others that people may not be aware of is the top five COVID vaccines were all formulated as gene therapies. That is to say, they had, many of them had a viral capsid surrounding a double-stranded DNA covering one large gene for the spike protein. So those are two widely used methods. I think we will see some for cognitive decline, neurodegenerative diseases very soon.
And for the layman, what precisely do you mean when you talk about gene therapy?
Gene therapy is typically the delivery of one or rarely multiple genes through a vehicle of some sort. The vehicle is either a protein virus-like capsid or it's a lipid membrane-like coating that allows you to deliver it either intravenous or intramuscular to either produce an immune reaction or to replace a protein that's missing or to do editing.
And that wouldn't affect the reproductive cycle, though?
It would not affect the reproductive genome, but it could affect the physiology of the person, just like there are a variety of drugs that can affect your physiology.
You've stressed all the positives that you believe can come for human health from genomics. Do you see any dangers?
Well, there are plenty of dangers in every technology, and I think we should not be glib or overly optimistic about new ones. All of them should go through some safety and efficacy testing. In the case of drugs, genomic diagnostics and therapies, the FDA, or in Europe, the EMA, and various other ones around the world are in charge of that safety and efficacy. We also should not be neglectful of the cost to so that everybody in the world, not just the rich, can benefit from it. Fortunately, the things that we've been talking about here are among the most radical positive cost reductions of any technology. So 20 million-fold reduction for sequencing and maybe a million-fold reduction in gene therapies for the original gene therapies versus the most recent ones. So those are the three main things, safety, efficacy, and affordability. Almost any new technology can be weaponized, even fertilizer and vehicles can be turned into bombs. But I think, again, that just requires surveillance and constant vigilance.
I mean, but if it was universally applied for benevolent ends, it would change the genetic content of the human race going forward quite significantly, wouldn't it? I mean, it would, as it were, breeding out some of these diseases.
I don't think we're necessarily breeding them out. I mean, what we're doing is making sure that no one is severely affected by a combination of therapies and preventatives. But yes, it would impact medicine more than it would impact our genetics.
And is this a technology and a science which is there, or are there still very major new discoveries that you and others need to make for this to work?
A huge fraction of it's already there. You know, 13 billion doses of COVID vaccine have been delivered, so it's been pretty extensively deployed in the world.
I mean, that did take a big effort by national governments, which they're probably not willing to make in other areas.
Well, there are other areas where it might be useful would be age-related diseases. So more people die of age-related diseases than just about anything else. It affects almost every other disease as well. And so that's a similar thing where billions of doses could bring the price down. And it was $2 a dose for at least one of the vaccines formulated as a gene therapy. And I think the same thing could affect diseases of aging. I think that would be quite attractive. And again, you could recover the investment in various ways.
And that would mean a massive increase in longevity, presumably.
More likely would mean, at least initially, would be healthier end-of-life years, possibly more years prior to retirement, if that's your goal. Healthier life is, I think, the goal.
And in terms of regulation, do you work in the United States run up against any difficulties? I mean, you know, we know there was a lot of public comment about stem cell research and where that could be carried out, for example. Do you feel regulatory constraints?
Speaking for myself and to a lesser extent, my trainees that now have started companies and for my close colleagues, I would say I haven't seen that much interference. I mean, the stem cell was relatively brief and was solved by focusing on adult stem cells largely. And that's been actually very productive and helpful. It's making its way into a variety of clinical settings. I think overall, the organizations like the FDA and the EPA for environment are doing their job, and we should be grateful that they're doing it. Whenever they're sped up too much, or somehow, you know, that something like thalidomide or Vioxx happens. And so I think we need to make sure that we're supportive of those watchdog organizations.
And you've worked a lot with colleagues in China. I mean, as you look around the world, are there any things which alarm you about the application of genomics?
Well, every new technology should alarm us, at least enough so that we make sure that the safeguards are in place. You know, I think in this case, the CFDA in China, it's called, is similar to the FDA in the way that in the United States and equivalent things in England and Europe. I think the safeguards are quite good. For example, for the COVID pandemic, they did better than the United States did in terms of death rate per capita.
Some people would say until now, but we'll have to see in that area, I think.
Yeah, that's true. They have citizens showing their desire for freedom, which is exactly what we did in the United States. It's an important trade-off between freedom and safety.
It seems to me that what you've done is really opened the door to a potential overhaul in medical treatment, people's experience of medical treatment and health and well-being throughout their lives. Potentially, would that be correct?
Yeah, I think that preventative medicine is going to be more humane and more cost-effective. It's already in widespread use in one way or another.
And people who talk about Dr. Frankenstein or eugenics or things like that, what do you say to them?
Well, I think some of my colleagues are not happy with any kind of criticism. I think criticism makes us stronger and more thoughtful. So I think the more imaginary dystopias one puts into the public, the less likely we're going to actually experience those other than in an imaginary sense. So that's a positive. Yeah, I think we need to be cautious. We need to have broad discussions and include not just experts, but all sorts of people, and to get all sorts of people's attention, non-scientists' attention. Sometimes you need some kind of entertainment vehicle, book or movie, to get the conversation going.
But at the same time, that can be based on a wild misunderstanding of the realities of the science, can it not?
Occasionally it's misunderstanding. More likely it's speculative, futuristic. I don't think we ever ran into a Frankenstein situation where people literally took body parts and reanimated them. But we do have, you know, a growing ability to make living things from non-living parts. So that wasn't completely off base. And that was one of the very early ones. You know, Jurassic Park, we now have Pleistocene Park that's aiming for restoring ancient species or at least ancient genes to enrich modern species. So these things are not that far off. And the point is that the more of these examples you have on the table, the more likely you are to, you know, pass laws or scientists just take it upon themselves to be more cautious.
So, I mean, you think that regenerating extinct species from genetic material is a live possibility?
I think the priority is using the diversity that you find in extinct species to help relatives that are endangered. So that some of the endangered species have lost diversity that is available now through looking at the genes that are widespread all over the globe. But it's not out of the question that one could go all the way, not just increase the diversity of modern species, but make an exact duplicate of something. In fact, that has happened for extinct viruses. For research purposes, they've been fully de-extincted. So yeah, it's feasible. I think the priority would be restoring ecosystems through rewilding efforts. There have been about 1,000 rewilding efforts where nearly extinct species have been brought back for the benefit of the environment.
You obviously think very deeply, not just about the science, but about the implications of your work. Are you optimistic about what it's going to bring to humanity in the coming generations?
I think just like it's important to thoroughly think through negative scenarios, it's important also to think through positive ones. I would not like my colleagues to be branded as pessimistic or optimistic necessarily. They're aiming for realism. But you can get caught unaware if the positives come much faster than you think. And this is what's happened in this field. It's moving faster even than computing technology, which is doubling about once a year or two. Some of the doublings in molecular biology have happened in a few months, that is to say, tenfold improvements per year. So if you're not ready for that, then there are economic missed opportunities. There are possibly regulatory issues. So I think rather than the word optimism, I would say, is it possible it goes faster than we expected? And I think there are many examples of that now, and we need to talk about that as well as the negatives.
George Church there on the present and future implications of genomics. But how is it actually done in the laboratory and the clinic? Central to that is a cutting-edge advance in gene editing known as CRISPR. That stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. Confused you won't be, because to explain what exactly it all means, I spoke to Kevin Davis, executive editor of the CRISPR Journal and author of Editing Humanity, The CRISPR Revolution, The New Era of Gene Editing, and The $1,000 Genome. So, what is CRISPR?
CRISPR is this revolutionary nickname, if you will, that we give to a new form of gene editing. So what do we mean by that? Well, over the last 20 or 30 years, we've made enormous progress in sequencing the human genome. We now know the exact sequence of the 3 billion subunits of DNA that make up the human genome, which is the code of life, the script that makes us who and what we are. So we've learned how to sequence the genome very, very cheaply. You referenced one of my earlier books, The $1,000 Genome. We can now sequence your genome or my genome for about $1,000 or less. So that's a wonderful breakthrough in and of itself. But over the last decade, we've seen even more astonishing progress in the ability to rewrite the genome, not just of humans, but potentially of any species. And CRISPR is the latest tool that has come along that allows us to dissect DNA sequences and, if you will, cut and paste, like as if we're editing a document on a word processor, the sequence of DNA, so that if there's a fault, if there's a genetic mutation, for example, in a gene that causes sickle cell disease or cancer or cystic fibrosis, scientists can now go in, use this tool called CRISPR, which I'll describe in a bit more detail shortly, and change the sequence to rectify it, to go back to what should be the normal healthy DNA sequence in that particular spot of the genome. And so with that comes the potential to treat patients with a huge catalogue of genetic diseases and do many other wild and wacky things besides.
Let's be clear about this. This is all about the next generation, as it were. It's about interfering with the DNA of parents, so it would be the children who'd be the beneficiaries.
Well, no. Absolutely. Well, that was one thread of the story, which I covered in detail in Editing Humanity, a very controversial, if not scandalous, part of the story, where scientists decided to muck around with the DNA of human embryos to, as you said, Adam, affect the genes, the DNA of the next generation. But what I'm talking about and what 99.999% of the field is talking about is treating you or me. So if you or any patient with a particularly serious genetic disease, for example, if their doctors felt that gene therapy or conventional medicines weren't the answer, we're now on the brink of a new revolution where scientists can administer CRISPR to a patient to repair their blood cells or repair their liver cells or some of the cells in the eyes that are causing blindness, or the list of applications is growing longer every week.
I mean, that's extraordinary. So this is actually, this is medicine. This is medicine, and managing to pick out, we're composed of billions of cells. This is managing to pick out individual cells, is it?
Well, we're composed of trillions of cells, and trillions. Yes, using CRISPR, delivering CRISPR either with a particular type of virus or some other delivery system, scientists can target particular cells in particular tissues or organs. This is 21st century precision medicine.
And CRISPR stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. I understand the words, but not the meaning.
The meaning doesn't really matter. The acronym is a reference to how CRISPR was discovered, and it's a great story, which I begin Editing Humanity telling. It's a story of scientists trying to understand. It had nothing to do with gene editing or personalized medicine, scientists were just trying to understand a curious bit of the genome in some species of bacteria, and they stumbled upon this weird set of sequences that had a strange repeating pattern to them, suggesting some sort of bizarre function, but nobody could figure out what it was until about 20 years ago, when some scientists did some computer searches and found that what bacteria were doing in this CRISPR array or section of their genome was storing little snippets of viral DNA. And what they encountered, what they'd stumbled on, was an immune system. So bacteria have different types of immune systems that try to provide a defense against viruses. And we've all been living through the pandemic. We know how complicated it is to maintain inoculations and vaccines against viruses. Well, bacteria have the same problem, except they've had it for, you know, billions of years on this planet. And this CRISPR is one of the systems that has evolved. And so what CRISPR does in nature is it provides a mechanism for bacteria to identify viral DNA trying to infect their cells and cut them. So that's how they destroy it, by literally cutting the DNA in half. And the way CRISPR was adapted for gene therapy or medical purposes was to take those same building blocks and say, well, if bacteria can cut viral DNA, if we just make a few tweaks here and there, maybe we can get this system to cut any DNA sequence. And that's the beginning of the editing process. That was the work that Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier published 10 years ago now in 2012 that led to them winning the Nobel Prize for Chemistry 2 years ago.
So you've got treatment of people changing their, put it crudely, their genetic code using CRISPR, but you can also use CRISPR to, what, engineer vaccines as well. Would that be right?
Some of the technologies for delivering CRISPR are the same as the technologies that have now been administered for RNA vaccines. So genetic diseases, there are thousands of them. They're caused by mistakes, typos in our genetic code. We know in most cases what those typos are. We know which cells in the body are most affected in different diseases. And so using CRISPR now, scientists and a growing number of biotech companies are designing CRISPR. The technology doesn't really change, but what changes, what is customized, is the sequence that you're looking to target. And that is, we synthesize a little bit of genetic material with a particular matching set of sequences so that the CRISPR system targets the gene that causes sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis or certain forms of muscular dystrophy. So every application is different, but the fundamental CRISPR gene editing system remains the same. And so that's now in clinical trials for a growing number of diseases. And I expect the first approvals will happen in 2023.
So as far as treating individuals who may have one medical condition or another, do you have to run their genome sequencing before you can treat them, as it were?
No, because if a patient presents with, say, sickle cell disease, then by definition, we know precisely what the mutation that that patient has. We know it down to the letter, down to the gene. So we don't need the full genome sequence in that case. So most of the scenarios that we're talking about, many of which are now in early clinical trials, the genes in question were, and the mutations within them, were identified 10, 20, 30, 40, in some cases 50 years ago. So yeah, we don't need to worry about doing a full genome sequence.
And how would the active agent, if I can put it that way, how would that be ingested? Would that be a pill? Would that be an injection?
Right now, they're done via injections. Maybe some sort of oral administration would be possible. Right now, there are two kind of flavors of CRISPR. We give them fancy Latin names, ex vivo and in vivo. All that means is that sometimes we take cells out of the patient and do the CRISPR treatment in the lab and then reinfuse those cells. So, for example, in the case of treating patients with sickle cell disease, we're trying to coax the stem cells that generate red blood cells. We're trying to kind of tweak them to make them express a healthy type of functioning hemoglobin that is usually expressed when we're fetuses in the womb, but then is naturally shut down shortly after birth. But those genes are still encoded in our DNA, still perfectly functional. If only we could kind of Sleeping Beauty-like give them a little kiss and wake them up. So that's what CRISPR is doing in that particular scenario. But for other diseases, whole growing list of liver diseases, for example, we can just put the CRISPR machinery in a little virus, and a not completely inert, innocuous virus, or some other type of material, a little fatty vesicle that we can inject, and then it will find its way to the liver in this particular scenario and be absorbed by the liver cells, which are the cells that we're trying to correct.
And once a patient has been treated in this way for themselves,
yeah,
would their future children also have that protection?
No. This is purely for one patient at a time.
Just how widespread is this sort of treatment of patients at the moment?
Still very, very early days. I don't want to give a faulty impression. And I think one of the caveats around this exciting technology is going to be when these therapies are eventually approved, and I've no doubt they will be, because the early results are spectacular. So briefly, in the first trial using CRISPR to get underway, it was for patients with sickle cell disease. It's being led by a couple of American biotech companies, Vertex Pharmaceuticals and CRISPR Therapeutics. But by now, they've treated some 70 or 80 patients. And to the best of my knowledge, many, if not all of these patients have now essentially been cured of sickle cell disease, which was an incurable disease for the last century since it was first described in the medical literature. So that result on its face is nothing short of astounding. The issue is going to be when these therapies are approved, how are the companies going to price them? And I fear we're going to see a bit of a mess, because I imagine, in keeping with other traditional gene therapies that have recently been approved, we're going to be hearing about price tags in probably the $2 to $3 million price range. But this is the problem when you're developing these breakthrough precision medicines. The companies need to reinvest in new, improved versions of their therapies, tackle different diseases, and of course, the expense of clinical trials. And this is just a problem with modern medicine at the moment.
Is the actual manufacture of the active agent, is that very, very expensive as well?
The manufacturing, it can become an issue depending on what the particular disease you want to tackle is. And if you're trying to treat a muscle disease where you need to correct billions of muscle fibers, then yes, you're going to need a lot more product than you might if you're just trying to treat, you know, a few photoreceptors in the back of the eye or something like that. But it's not really that. I think it's more just the time and effort and the hundreds of scientists and clinicians who've been involved in building these companies, getting them off the ground, getting the trials underway. And, you know, it's companies want that good old return on investment. And so hence the hefty price tag when these things are eventually approved.
The ethical problems of supply and demand are dwarfed, really, aren't they, by the problem of what people would probably call eugenics or genetic engineering. What issues have already come up in connection with that?
Well, the big scandal that involved CRISPR came in 2018 when a Chinese scientist, He Jiankui, secretly and deliberately edited the DNA of human embryos with the misguided attempt to render the ensuing children HIV resistant. So he recruited a small number of couples where the dad in the couple, the male in the couple, had HIV. There's a gene that we know called CCR5 that, when knocked out, leads to HIV resistance. And so He Jiankui, I'll just nickname him JK, decided to take it upon himself to edit the DNA of these children before they were born to introduce this HIV resistance gene, quote unquote, if you will. If he'd asked or polled the scientific community or the medical establishment beforehand, he would have been told resoundingly, don't do it. There's no need. There's no unmet medical need to do this. There's other steps in the clinic that we can take to using IVF to avoid HIV transmission. But he went ahead and did it anyway. So this story erupted in the end of November 2018. The story was scooped by a brilliant journalist in Boston, Antonio Regalado. And a few hours later, JK posted a series of videos that he pre-recorded announcing the births of these two children in China, Lulu and Nana, carrying these edited genes. Those will, if they remain healthy and have children of their own, those edited genes would be passed on to their children and into the human gene pool. So that's why people were so up in arms about it. The fate or the health of those children, we know nothing about. The Chinese have not revealed anything about them.
And do they have the immunity from HIV as well?
We've no idea. We have absolutely no idea. We know that the gene in question was pretty messed up because the sequences were reported at a scientific conference in 2018, but the manuscript was never published. And JK, once the tide, once the overwhelming voice of public opinion and scientific opinion came down on him, the Chinese authorities just immediately put him in detention, threw the book at him, and he was imprisoned for the better part of 3 years. He got out earlier this year and has now moved his lab from Shenzhen to Beijing. He's not supposedly working in gene editing anymore, but he is trying to rehabilitate his image and try to give back to the scientific community.
Because it's important to say that in most parts of the world, I don't know about China, actually doing that would be against the law, wouldn't it?
Well, in many parts of the world, exactly, there are explicit laws that would prevent that. But it was more the feeling that if we're going to take that enormous step to tinker with the DNA of human beings, of the species, then we need to consult other members of the species. We need to do it openly and make sure that there is a true medical necessity and rationale for doing that. And so in the aftermath of JK's the scandal and his imprisonment in 2019, various committees were put together. And one of them, the leading one that was chaired by Dame Kay Davis at Oxford, no relation, came up with the conclusions that embryo editing is not in and of itself something that should be completely banned in the future if it can be shown to be safe and can do something that no other medical technology can achieve, then we should leave the door open for potential applications. And so some of those applications, it's very rare scenarios. It might be where, if, for example, if two individuals who both have a serious genetic disease like sickle cell or cystic fibrosis wish to have a biological child, a healthy biological child, then there's no current IVF procedure that would allow them to do that. But gene editing, where you would go in and clean up the mutation in one copy or both copies of the cystic fibrosis gene, then that's one potential scenario. But if you crunch the numbers on the back of an envelope, we're potentially talking of a very small number of applications. So that's what the sort of scientific establishment thinks. But I'm worried that there's still going to be enough incentive for some rogue operators to launch a kind of a CRISPR clinic, if you will, in some medical tourism hotspot that is perhaps untouchable by the authorities. So I fear we've not yet heard the last of this designer baby scandal.
And in the sense that every time a couple conceive, they are involved in genetic engineering of one kind or another. I mean, what is wrong with that if it's done to eliminate disease or prevent genetic abnormalities? I mean, is it just that it might so easily go wrong?
Well, there is that, certainly that concern. And if you're, and that, I think that's one of the pragmatic concerns at the moment, is that we don't understand enough about how repairs to DNA in early stage human embryos, 2, 4, 8 cells or whatever, we don't understand how that works. When people have tried, responsible scientists now have tried with no intention of reimplanting embryos, but just try to understand the fundamental biology of gene editing in early stage human embryos, they find that the genomes get really messed up, to use a technical term. So we've got to do a lot more basic research there. If you have a family history of a genetic disease and you wish to have ensure that that gene is not passed on, then there are already many techniques that can be used in the clinic using modified forms of IVF, in vitro fertilization. And the most commonly used one is called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So we can do an IVF procedure, grow the early stage embryos for a couple of days in the lab, and then we can remove one or a couple of the cells from each embryo and study the DNA. It's like a genetic biopsy, if you will, and decide which of those embryos are carrying the faulty gene. And if we identify those, then we know not to reimplant those embryos and just go ahead and implant the embryos that are likely to result in a healthy baby.
CRISPR's the future of medicine.
Big words, yours, not mine, but I think it's certainly one of the tools, and I'm excited to see where it can go. But of course, it's not just about medicine. So many other applications, you know, agriculture, feeding the planet, generating new strains of crops and fruits and plants that can resist pests and parasites and climate change. That's, in some cases, some people think that's an even more important application down the road of CRISPR than treating hundreds or thousands of patients with genetic diseases over the next 5 or 10 years.
And what do you say to people who draw parallels with Dr. Frankenstein, say this is an area where humanity should not trespass?
One of the challenges that the developers of CRISPR and the companies that are commercializing it will have to grapple with is to assure, as I believe, the public that these technologies are safe. We're not introducing any foreign funky genes into our plants or the foods that we eat. We're simply using technology to stealthily change a sequence of DNA here or there, and in some cases to go back to what nature intended or what we would produce using natural breeding techniques, but they would take tens of years that we may not have to bring about. So let's use the technology that people have invented for the better good.
That was Kevin Davis on the future of gene editing. Many thanks to him and to Professor Church. This episode of Worldview for Engelsberg Ideas was funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The producer was Murray Jessel, assistant producer Eve Webster, and sound engineer Gareth Jones. I'm Adam Bolton. We'll be back in the new year. Until then, thanks for listening.